We have some dates coming up that are important for you to keep in mind. The debt ceiling, next debt ceiling debate is going to be sometime in mid-May. The continuing resolution expires on September 30th. We're going to try to work with the Senate to do regular appropriations bills between now and September 30th so that we don't have any continuing resolution extending into fiscal 2014, which begins October 1st. The fiscal 2014 appropriations bills, as we said, hopefully are going to be done between now and then. Let's look at a little bit of an economic overview. The U6 unemployment rate, which is unemployed, underemployed, and those who are getting out for work, is 14.3%. That's about 1.1 out of every 7 Americans, of our friends and neighbors, doesn't have work that they'd like to have. We have about 12 million unemployed workers, and we've got folks that we've got almost 5 million Americans that have been employed for more than 27 weeks. And as we all know, the longer you're employed, the harder it is to get a job as we go forward. These are some things to keep in mind. When the stimulus bill passed back in 2009, we were promised that by now that unemployment would be 5.2%. The official rate today is 7.7%. But because of something called labor force participation, where people have just dropped out of the workforce and caused that higher U6 unemployment rate, we have those people come out of the calculation for the unemployment rate. If you put them back in, if you modify the labor force, if you take into account the impact of labor force participation rate, unemployment today would be 10.8%. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not how you build a successful growing economy when you have 10 to 14% of your population is not working. Now let's talk about policies. The average post-World War II expansion has created about 290,000 jobs a month during the recovery. Under the Reagan administration, we created 372,000 jobs a month. Under this administration, or under the current recovery, we've had 176,000 jobs a month. Again, there are policy choices out there that work to grow economies, and it has to do with taxes and regulatory structures and the impact of the federal government on American lives. I'd like to spend a minute on good governance. We have passed, I have helped co-sponsor, or been the original sponsor, of several pieces of legislation that basically say that make government smarter. One that I introduced in the last Congress, which version 2.0 will be introduced in the next few weeks, is Reconnecting Congress with America. And basically what that says is that a member of Congress has his or her pay cut if they don't pass budgets, if they don't pass appropriations bills, if the deficits are high, or they're missing votes because they're out campaigning for president or Senate. It also says that we would eliminate the federal pension for members of Congress. There's no reason for members of Congress to have a pension system that's different from the people they represent. I would have a 401k and Social Security just like everybody else, and that's what we're trying to do. And also, you know, we've seen some abuses in the past where Congress doesn't live under the laws that it passes, and we believe that it should, and so that's included in Reconnecting Congress of America. Now, there are a whole bunch of other issues. I'm going to try to keep the introduction short. We could talk about American energy security. You could talk about hydraulic fracturing. You could talk about the Endangered Species Act, which we're going to try to address in this Congress, the Keystone XL pipeline, Second Amendment gun control, marriage, immigration, Medicaid expansion by the states. But let's save that for the questions and answers. How's that? Is that okay with you? Now, again, if you remember, if you haven't turned your question already, if you have a question, hold your hand up and one of our team or interns or volunteers will pick your question. So, all right, with that, Scott.
All right, let's get started. First question is from Paul Posky, who asks, how do we leverage social media where young, uninformed voters live and work to inform them of the realities and the dangers of bad policy choices and to teach them basic economics?
I think that, I'm not saying I'm not a good example of it. I did win the MTV Award in Texas, so for social media. Social media is just another form of media. I mean, we've got WTAW, we've got KBTX, we've got the Eagle. To me, Facebook and Twitter can be used, and even YouTube can be used as successful tools to help explain, and I'm not going to limit this to young Americans, all Americans, about just another way to reach out and touch so that all voters have, or actually broader voters, all constituents have the information they need to know about what's going on in Washington. So I would say that we ought to just, for lack of a better term, use the Nike commercial, just do it. So that's what I say.
Next question is from Brandy Collier. With immigrants needing at least 2 years education or job experience equivalents for that, would it be beneficial to move to educate through teaching skills? What should we do for those immigrants? That's the first of one many immigration questions.
Okay, say that one again.
Okay. And Brandy, you can help me, Brandy. Okay. I'm going to read it. You tell me if I missed something. With immigrants needing at least a two-year education or job experience equivalent to that, could it be beneficial to move to educate and teach skills? Now, then you say, as TR would say, spend and he spent. Could you help me with that?
Spend and be spent.
Spend and be spent.
Let me do this. Let's talk about, maybe I can answer a whole bunch of immigration questions kind of all at one time, if I can. How many of you think immigration is a big issue? Okay. I do too. How many of you think we ought to try to get it solved sooner rather than later? Okay, I'm with you. If you look at the immigration issue, you've got a lot of sub-issues. And so let's kind of walk through those. You've got border security has got to be a critical part of immigration. You've got a bunch of folks here that are here illegally, that are living in the shadows. You've got to deal with them. You've got the children of those that are here illegal. We call them dreamers sometimes. We've got to deal with them. You've got employers that are trying to staff positions that sometimes turn to illegal help, either knowingly or unknowingly, and so you've got to deal with that. And then you've got a naturalization process, and Judge Langley is still here. He naturalized 200 citizens this month, last month. And so that process takes 7 to 11 years. Now let's go through these. How do you address these? How many of you think about having stronger border security? Okay, I agree we need to do that. One of the things you hear about in Washington is you hear about comprehensive immigration solutions. I worry about the term. I think we need to have a comprehensive set of solutions to immigration, but I'm not sure you can do it all as one solution, because that's like building a sandwich. And every time you build a sandwich to try to cover everything, you're going to find people don't like the bread or the choice of meat or the pickles or whatever. And so I think we need to address them in discrete pieces. With respect to border security, I agree we need to strengthen our border, and that ought to be a key part of any immigration solution. If we deal with, and that takes me to the next part. In order to deal with the illegals that are here, you need to make sure that you don't somehow encourage some more to come across, and that's the reason to have border security. What we need to do, in my view, with those folks that are here today, is give them a path to legal status. Not amnesty, but a path to legal status. They're out of compliance with the law. Find a way for them to square themselves with the law. Is it a fine? Is it paying back taxes? Is it deferred adjudication? Some solution like that. And once they're square with the law, give them some sort of a temporary visa. Find out who they are, ID them, and then they can have a job. They can live here. They can raise their families here, pay taxes. And that way, they become a productive part of society instead of living on the fringe. With respect to the dreamers, the folks, the children of those folks that came here through no fault of their own. But, you know, we've got to find a way to deal with that group. And this state, we educate them. But then, when they're done with their education, say, leave, go home. Well, they don't have a home. This is their home for all they know. So find a way, once their parents have squared themselves with the law, where they're squared too. This is where I have the weakest policy with solutions, because I don't have all the answers when it comes to the dreamers. But I think we've got to find a way to deal with it so that they're educated and they become productive taxpayers. They become contributors to society instead of potential drains on society. And then when we look at the people that JD naturalizes everybody, they spent 7-11 years, they're better, they know more about the United States of America and our Constitution than most kids come out of high school today, most kids come out of college today. And so, to me, we can get that same value out of the naturalization process, but shorten it to 2 to 4 years. So some people talk about the path to citizenship. I'd say the path to citizenship ought to be a multi-step process. It ought to be your path to legal status. And then for those people, the small percentage of those folks that came here, most of them, let me rephrase that, most of them came here just to get a job. But if for that small percentage that want to become citizens, let them go through a streamlined naturalization process. Like everybody else, though. They don't get to the head of the line. They don't jump in line in front of anybody else. They get in the same line as those that are doing it in the proper way. But I see no reason, based on the folks that I've met that have spent 7-11 years and spent tens of thousands of dollars, that we need to make it that tough. Because I think you can teach the Constitution in 2 years and teach what it means to be an American in 2 years. So I think we need to deal with that. So those are my solutions. I mean, how many of you like that, those solutions? How many of you don't like it? You got a few that don't like it. So those are the things. No amnesty, though. Again, if you square yourself with the law, then amnesty is not an issue because you fit. You know, a speeding ticket is not a good analogy. But if you get a speeding ticket and you pay your fine, well, you're square with the law. And so, you know, that's what we're looking at. And I don't know how many of those will answer. I mean, how many of the immigration questions will answer, but I'll leave that to you, Judge.
Okay, well, there are a few specifics. Jacob Cobb, who is a member of Texas A&M's Council on Minority Student Affairs, representing CMSA and the National Immigration Network, known as United We Draw, the RNC has come out in support of immigration reform. Borders have never been stronger, more secure. We have record numbers of deportations of undocumented immigrants. His question is, what are your plans to protect Aggies and community members and push for that reform?
Well, I think I don't differentiate. I mean, when you look at immigration, I don't. Don't differentiate Aggies from anybody else. I mean, you've got a bunch of people. You know, we need a visa system that matches what the economy tells us we need. Whether you have a STEM education visa, so somebody can come here and they can do their postgraduate work in the STEM fields, and then stay and go work for Apple over in Austin, which is in my district, in District 17, or work at HP that's in District 17, or work here at Texas A&M. You might need an ag visa so that those folks that do ag labor could come in and work for the farmers who need help here. We've got hotels here in town that pay folks $10-$11 an hour, but they can't get enough help. And so maybe you have a hospitality visa so that people can come in and they can provide the services on a legal basis that we need here. Maybe there's another type of visa, but basically have a multi-lane highway of visas that's drawn by labor that we can't fill indigenously, I mean, through our own labor supply. And I think we'll be a faster growing, healthier economy if we do this with this multi-lane visa system. And again, it's not based on the stupid lottery that we have today and based on people getting in these long lines. It's based on what we need for the economy right now. And that way you come in and you get all the help you need, but you don't displace domestic labor. And I don't see that doesn't differentiate against versus Aggies or anybody else for that nature. It's if you got a skill that we need, if you pass a security check on it.
Next is, I guess, a game plan question for the Republican Party. Ron Darby asks, as long as Harry Reid is in charge of the Senate, there's a snowball's chance of getting any House bills through the Senate. Is there a strategy for addressing the problem?
I think when it comes, and this is still immigration, I assume.
Oh, no, I think anything. Yeah, I think he's talking about anything.
Let me finish on immigration. The answer to the question is probably not, except with respect to immigration. I do think that based on the progress I'm seeing and the conversations I'm seeing in Congress today, we can find a bipartisan, bicameral solution to immigration. We've got a group of eight folks in the House that are bipartisan and have been working on immigration for 3 years. excuse me, 4 years. We've got a bipartisan group of eight in the Senate that have been working on immigration for a while. And Marco Rubio is sort of the lead face of that that you see from time to time. I'm part of the Immigration Reform Caucus that the Speaker of the House has put together. Ted Poe from here in Texas is the chair of that. And we're all working on solutions. And I think if people can trust each other and exercise good judgment and goodwill, we can get this thing done and get it off the table. And I think the economy will be better off as a result of this. It would be good. So, yes, with respect to immigration, probably no with respect to most other things unless you have a crisis. Will we get anything done in Congress? You have a difference in ideology. I mean, I pointed out the two graphs on the chart as far as difference in visions for America. One vision is the federal government is the solution for all problems for everybody. The other solution is American people and American individuals and private enterprise are a better solution, and solutions closer to home are better to deal with American, with the issues that we face as a country. And so with Harry Reid, he's got one vision. In the House, we've got a different vision. It's going to be hard to reconcile those for the near future.
Help us first about maybe definitions with baseline budgeting and zero-based budgeting, and then we can talk about that.
Well, first of all, I hate baseline budgeting because families don't use baseline budgeting to budget with. Let's go to this. Gosh, it's a lot further back there than I thought. Sorry. Okay. That red line is a representation of the way the Congressional Budget Office builds our budget. They assume that current policy stays in effect forever, and then they escalate it a little bit, and so they show federal spending growing all the time. Let me give you a couple of really egregious examples. You know, federal government's going to spend about $35 billion on Sandy relief, remember Superstorm Sandy, on Sandy relief this year, and then about $25 billion next year. The CBO assumes that $25 billion just keeps going forever. Well, how many of you think that's really going to happen? It's not. Now, the other thing is the war on terror. We're going to spend the neighborhood of about $85 billion in Afghanistan and in other parts of the world in the war on terror this year. The Pentagon says that's going to cost about $43 billion next year. But the CBO builds in $85 billion for as long as I can see, as far as I can see. That's baseline budget. That's stupid. You don't do it that way. Well, we have passed in the House as budget, several pieces of budget reform. One is zero-based budgeting. You start over at zero every year, you build your budget up the same way that Texas A&M does, or any of the businesses in this community, or the way that you do as a family. And so I hope that explains the difference. Now, again, that's one of those things where it's going to be hard to reform the budget process until you get some help over in the Senate. But, I mean, how many of you believe that zero-based budgeting is a solution for the future? How many of you want us to keep doing the way we're doing it? Okay, well, I'm with the former group.
Well, if we get zero, let me ask a question. If we get zero out here, we want to continue that. Are you telling me that the will of Congress is to continue with the idea of baseline budgeting?
Not the will, but the practical result is yes. I mean, how stupid is that? I mean, yourself in my shoes. And you came from the real world, and you go to Washington. He's like, why in the world would we do something so stupid? Why would we? And so, for people like me, it's just frustrating as heck. And that's the reason. You've got my commitment to continue to try to fix this stuff as we go forward.
Lloyd Dean asked a question I think we get every time. What are we doing as far as your point of view in supporting the fair tax?
I'm another original co-sponsor of the fair tax this year for this Congress. Good job. I still agree that we need the fair tax. The economy is starting to get a little bit healthier. I don't think it's time to implement the fair tax today. But let's say that we get unemployment back down to 5%. It looks like that's still a ways off. But if we get unemployment down to 5% and the economy's at a little better utilization rate than it is, then I'd say we ought to have a 5 to 10 year transition period to kill the income tax and to implement the fair tax. A fair tax, just for those of you that don't know what it is, it's essentially a national sales tax, but it's done in a way where it's not regressive, where it doesn't hurt your lower-income Americans. And it does it by giving lower-income Americans a prebate, essentially a check from the government that represents the amount of sales tax they pay on a certain income level and below for their consumption. And that way, they're neutral. But everybody else above that income level pays the same amount of tax on every purchase that everybody else does. It's fair. It has a broad base. It's cheap to collect, and it's easy to collect because we already do it at point of sale today. And that way, you know, the chunk of our economy that's in the underground economy suddenly is helping to pay for the government that they're getting. And I believe it's a solution to fix things as we go forward. The other thing that happens is don't assume, let's say you pay $4 a gallon for a gallon of gasoline, the gasoline might be okay. Let's say you pay, you know, a few dollars for a loaf of bread. Don't assume that it's automatically going to go up by 17 to 25% number this year, because what you do first, you strip all the income taxes out of that cost of loaf of bread first, and then you add the tax to it. So the loaf of bread would hopefully cost around the same or slightly more, but you're paying no income tax.
More and more business is being done on the internet. Will Congress take on an internet tax?
That might happen this, well, in terms of an internet tax, I don't think there's going to be a tax on internet transactions, but I do think that the different tax treatment that online vendors get versus brick and mortar vendors get, I think that's going to wind up going away sometime. So those of you that own a bookstore here in town that are having to collect sales tax from your customers and you know, other online bookstores are not collecting sales tax, I think you're going to see that go away. I'm not a big supporter of that, but I think logically and fairness, you have to say it's probably the right thing to do. You might wind up having that pass in this country.
Hollis Bracken has several questions having to do with vets, so we'll kind of go through it a piece at a time and what sequestration is going to do for that. First question is, how will sequestration affect the GI Bill for veterans?
It doesn't. That's all veterans programs are exempt from sequestration. Even the overhead of the Veterans Administration is exempt. So.
Okay, that includes Hazelwood Act as well.
Hazelwood Act is Texas.
Okay, and you said also that apparently funding will be there for veterans who want to continue their education or active duty.
Active duty will get tuition support.
Okay.
So that was easy.
Yeah, it was. And hire veterans, what can you tell us about this? What employers will be subject to this?
The vow to Hire Veterans Act, I don't have the exact date, but I'm going to get Jeff, look that up for me real quick. It goes into effect pretty quickly, and I think some parts have already gone into effect, but I don't remember exactly.
Okay.
It's a great piece of legislation that helps encourage business to hire our nation's veterans. How many of you are veterans? Let's give you a round of applause. Do we have any active duty military in here? Reserves or guard? Okay. Thank you for your service.
Congressman, we have had a couple of questions that really were based on the idea that Easterwood's tower might not be closed. You addressed that's going to be funded on the state level.
Correct.
How long does that last, and what is the future of that?
By the way, I appreciate the leadership of the state of Texas. So if you see our local folks, John Rainey or Kyle Cassell or Charles Schwertner, or you see Lieutenant Governor, the governor, thank them for stepping in and fixing a stupid activity of the federal government and keeping that tower open. It's going to be open for 3 months initially. We'll see what happens after this. My thinking is that beginning in October the 1st, that the Congress is not going to have any appetite to keep the sequester in place and instead find smart ways to cut the budget, keep the spending levels down, but cut it in smart ways. Like I said, I could cut $85 billion in the budget. You'd never even know what happened.
So will Texas have to fund this next year then? Your view is the sequester goes away?
In my view, the state will be funding it for 3 months beginning in April through early July. We could be at risk for July through September. I don't know. The sequester is going to stay in effect unless we replace it with other cuts. We're not going to undo the sequester and raise spending. That's not going to happen. That is off the table. The federal government's gotten fat. We need to trim that 5 pounds off that 200-pound person. And so I don't know what to say, Lou. I know that we're not going to reverse it, so the tower could wind up being closed again. But if my bill passed to cut out the free cell phone, we could fund that and White House tours and all kinds of stuff. So, and send on a carrier to where it's needed in the Middle East.
Alan Waldy asks, would you discuss gun law that is pending?
How many of you support the Second Amendment? Okay. How many of you think we need tighter gun controls? Okay, we've got a few. I'm more with the first group. Look, just my personal perspective is I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I have a concealed carry permit. I own guns. I carry guns. And if you look at Dianne Feinstein's bill, if it were law on the day that Sandy Hook happened, Sandy Hook would have still happened. So why pass a law that doesn't change the outcome? Why not look at what's causing things? Why does somebody pick up a gun, a baseball bat, a knife, a hammer, a car, whatever, and use it as a weapon? What causes that violence? Do we have mental health issues we need to deal with? Yes. Do we need to spend more time looking at mental health issues? Yes. Do we need to look at the impact of our society today on violence? We need to look at video games, film, whatever it is. We need to address the underlying cause and quit trying to pick on the weapon. That's my view. And so I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, and I'm not going to vote for anything that really doesn't get at the underlying cause of why somebody picks up a weapon and uses it against somebody else. Our second amendment is pretty clear. The right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, period. It's pretty simple, and that's the way I believe.
Paul Wainwright asks, the UN today passed a vote on international arms control. This would seem to conflict with our Second Amendment. How would that be resolved?
Well, I don't think the Senate the Senate would have to put it up as a treaty, and the President would have to put it up as a treaty for the Senate to ratify. I don't think the Senate would ratify it, so we're not going to be subject to it, in my view. And even if the Senate did do something stupid and ratify it, we'll be trying to undo that in the House as quick as we can.
Charles Akins writes, by holding interest rates artificially low, the Fed is transferring wealth from the citizens to the government. This doesn't differ materially from the action that is taking place in the banks in Cyprus. What can be done to stop this taxation without representation?
I don't know that it simply transfers anything, but I will tell you it's horrible economic policy. The Federal Reserve is essentially, just for those of you that don't realize, the Chinese have quit buying their debt by and large. And the Federal Reserve is printing money to essentially fund the deficits that the federal government is running. And so we're growing our money supply at this huge rate, but we're not seeing any impact on the economy. All we're doing is slowing down. How many economists do we have in here? A few. We're slowing down the multiplier impact, the way money's deployed. We're just building up this huge inflationary cycle. And eventually we're gonna have interest rates skyrocket. Let me give you an example of what happens. Today, interest rates are at some of the lowest levels I think we've ever seen in our history. And our federal government pays about $300 billion a year for the interest on that debt. What happens if interest rates go back to normal levels? Our interest cost is going to go to over $900 billion a year. That's about 150 to 160% of what we pay for our national defense. You can see the crowding out impact that's going to have on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, basic research grants to Texas A&M. You can see the impact for veterans' benefits. It's going to be huge. And so if we can get the federal government to get out of the way so that the economy can grow, the Federal Reserve wouldn't have to do it. I disagree with what the Federal Reserve is doing. But in some ways, it's acting like the only adult in the room to help avoid having an economic calamity. But by doing so, they're building in one in the future. So my goal is to have tax reform, reform the regulatory structure in Washington, rely on things like all of the above, American Energy Solutions, so that we can grow our economy and get the Federal Reserve out of the picture.
Ian Overton and Dash Lee basically questions are very similar in that they mention reenacting the Glass-Steagall Act, if you'd explain that, and then also Title II of Dodd-Frank and what that has done.
Oh, gosh.
Let's start with Glass-Steagall.
Well, Glass-Steagall basically says, just in a nutshell, banks can't use customer capital to make investments. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but that's the simplest thing. So when you put a deposit in a bank, that bank is not putting that deposit at risk to investigate it, I mean, to invest in junk mortgage loans or anything like that. The Glass-Steagall Act was done away with, and so banks began to do that. And so there is some view that we need to re-implement Glass-Steagall so you separate those activities so banks aren't putting those things at risk. I don't have a real problem with that. I don't have a problem with leaving, with putting Glass-Steagall back into place. But I do want to give you a caveat to that answer. I'd like to look into it a little bit more. But I do think it's improper for banks to put your deposits at risk by their investments. And so somehow we need to stop that. Dodd-Frank is not the solution to that, by the way. Dodd-Frank is killing our community banks. For those of you that have tried to get mortgages, it's made it tougher to get mortgages. For those of you that have lower incomes, it's made it more difficult for banks to give you just a basic checking account, so you're forced to go use a payday lender. It has not been good for anybody. And you know what? What caused this economic crisis we had, this financial crisis we had? Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in Congress. Did Dodd-Frank fix any of those three things? No. It killed all the innocent bystanders, but it left the guilty parties standing up. And so, to me, you get rid of Dodd-Frank and you start over and you go look at those government-sponsored entities, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And you find a way to fix what they're doing today and ultimately sunset them out of the picture when there's a private mortgage solution out there, when the private sector steps up. And then you don't have that happen again. And then you find a better way to regulate the activities the way banks use their capital.
This question, Congressman Flores, have you been following the recent news exposés on C-Scope and Common Core's projects, the personal data mining on students, which includes family income, religious affiliation, eye color, blood type, health care plan, etc., homework formation, and is this would seem to be an intrusive form of gathering data. And some of these are prohibited by the Protection of Pupil Rights Amendment, the Obama administration paving the way for private entities to buy this data. The FERPA document outlines 11 different ways that personality identifiable information can be shared by schools without parental or student consent.
I have not followed Common Core or C-Scope, but when you look at the Constitution doesn't say that the federal government ought to be setting educational standards for every local school district in the country. And so to the extent that you set a Common Core, it may be okay to write it and draft it, leave it up to the states and local school districts to implement. But I don't think the federal government ought to be trying to cram that down the throats of Bryan ISD or College Station ISD. I just don't. I don't know that much about C-Scope at all, but I can tell you, if the federal government is willing to do this to you, with this 21-page application, how many of you think this is a good way to conduct business? How many of you want to give this information to the federal government? I don't. So, in my view, we need to keep the federal government out of that type of intrusive behavior with education.
This question, what do you think are the chances that Obamacare will end up back in front of the Supreme Court because it was ruled a tax, and according to the Constitution, all taxes are supposed to originate in the House?
I don't think Obamacare is going to be back in front of the Supreme Court. I will tell you this, when they start to hit your mailboxes, Obamacare is going to be back in front of the American people. When companies that manufacture medical devices, which include like can include like an app on your iPhone where you pay a device tax for that, when those manufacturers and providers start moving overseas, the American people are going to start to talk about Obamacare. When the taxes hit in on when you do a real estate transaction, you're paying an extra Medicare tax on your above your capital gains on your real estate transaction. You're going to start talking about Obamacare. It's going to take the American people telling Washington they've had enough of this. And I've voted 30-some times to defund it, to get rid of it, to repeal it, to fix it, to replace it. What I've asked our leadership and the House of Representatives to do, our freshmen are up there and they're mad as heck because they want to vote on Obamacare. They haven't had one. I keep telling John Boehner, you need to put one on the floor and let them have a chance to vote it out. Then pass the House. We'll get Democrats to vote to kill Obamacare. And then let the Senate see what they're going to do. You know, they passed something in their budget. One of the few good parts of their budget is they passed a provision to deal with the vice tax. They get what's happening. So, you know, things like this throw up the American people, like high gasoline prices, and things begin to happen in Washington when the American people get mad.
Tom Tamer asks, you mentioned a $1.2 trillion increase in taxes in January. What is included in that computation?
There were I don't remember the total number of taxes on Obamacare, but there were a bunch of different taxes on Obamacare. For instance, as I talked about, your capital gains rates are going to go up. Basically, all your unearned income is going to be taxed at the Medicare rate in addition to the normal tax rate. So you're going to pay that tax in addition. Device manufacturers, medical device manufacturers are paying tax. You know, you get a new hip. The hospitals are going to pay a tax. They're going to pass that along to you. So that $1.2 trillion is built in is the amalgamation of all those individual taxes.
And finally, a question we didn't get, but I think some folks would be curious. The talk is certainly ratcheted up in North Korea. I'd like to get your response to how the United States is responding there.
North Korea, I think, is exploiting the... Well, first of all, I think that guy's crazy.
We got to hear them.
What's that? I just think the guy's nuts. And but, you know, a young, nutty person can be really dangerous, particularly when they've got the capabilities they have with their missiles and also with their nuclear program. And so I wish we could find a way to deliver a consistently tough message to them to let them know if you mess with us or you mess with our ally, South Korea, there's going to be heck to pay. And, you know, for instance, we have a missile defense system that was being put in place in the West Coast in Alaska that was shelved 4 years ago. Now we've decided, well, we've got to get some of those back up in place. Well, that initial decision to shelve that was not a strong signal to send the world. Our decision in Eastern Europe to shelve our missile defense system over there was not the right kind of signal to send to North Korea. It basically says, look, we're willing to sort of, you know, not protect ourselves, to leave ourselves vulnerable. And when you show the world that you're going to leave yourself vulnerable, some folks are going to try to take advantage of you. And so I worry about this young man that's a leader of North Korea. I worry about what he's trying to do to motivate to you know, win the hearts and minds of his citizens, and then also show how he's the bully in the world. I worry about that.
That concludes our questions.
You're kidding.
We're done. You answered them all.
Oh, okay. Well, this is a new record for a town hall meeting. We've got a couple of other pieces of information. Y'all caught me off guard on that one. We have a congressional art competition. And by the way, what was the, can you give me the date on Battle High Girls?
It was November 21st,
2011. Okay. So it's in effect today. All provisions of it?
Yes.
Okay. So the question about Battle High Girls Act went into effect in November 2011. I thought that was when it passed. And it became effective immediately. Okay, thanks. We have congressional art competition. If any of you know a budding artist in high school, be sure to let them know to sign up. They can go to forest.house.gov, congressional art competition. One of the funnest things about this job, or one of the things about this job is fun, is when that young man or woman comes to Washington and Southwest Airline gives us two tickets to give to them to come up, and we get to hang it in the walkway of the Capitol from the Cannon office building, from the office buildings over the Capitol. It's really a neat deal. For those of you that are inclined to follow, there's an association out there that rates members of Congress. Some are liberal, some are conservative, some are special interest. We have this information available if you're interested in how I score certain things. I tend to do higher on the conservative scores. I tend to do a little less well on the liberal scores. Last year at this time, I had a 3% liberal action score. I was fortunate to get that back down to 0%. So anyway, I wanted to let you know that. This I didn't impress some of you guys, I'm sure. But there are ways to stay involved with us. Thanks. Go to Forrest. I have to sign up for our emails. We try to send out an email weekly to bi-weekly. You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. If there's anything else you want to let us know, you can call our office or you can submit forms on our website through a contact form or you can send us emails.